Hello, everybody. It's my pleasure today to have Jeff Isaacson here, who's come from UCSD, who's going to tell us about central circuits governing olfaction. Jeff Isaacson has had an interesting career, and he was telling me a lot about it today when we were driving into work, hanging out in that horrible long line through the where you have the visitors to drive through. But I think the thing about Jeff's work is he has just basically done so many important fundamental things about how synapses work. And you look back over his publications and you see that he's worked on glutamate and GABA diffusion to synapses. He works on postsynaptic glutamate and GABA receptors. He's worked in the hippocampus, in the brainstem. He's now working in the olfactory cortex. He's worked in the olfactory bulb. And as a synaptic physiologist myself, you look at his work and you realize he's made many of the fundamental discoveries in synaptic physiology, which a lot of people of my generation are base our work on. And so it's a real pleasure to have him here today. Just to give you the brief rundown of his extensive and varied career, he's a PhD with Roger Nicol at UCSF, where he told me he was the only person not working on LTP in the lab. And then he went on to work in Newcastle in Australia with Bruce Walmsley and Pankaj Sah, working on quantal properties of synaptic transmission in the cochlear nucleus. He then came back from Australia and went to work in the University of Washington in Seattle with Bertil Hill, working on presynaptic receptors in the hippocampus, GABA-B receptors. And in the late 1990s, he finally gave up being a postdoc and finally took the plunge and started his own lab at UCSD. And at that point, he switched to the olfactory bulb, where he did some really fundamental work on the circuits in the olfactory bulb and the physiology of the olfactory bulb circuitry. And then he's moved up a level in terms of up to the cortex and the olfactory cortex, and is actually now finally working on long-term synaptic plasticity and even LTP. So he's sort of come back around full circle. So, his work has been characterized by these elegant, beautiful studies that are just classics in the literature, that you just go back and you read again and again and again. And it's a real pleasure to have him talking here today. And he's going to tell us about his latest work on the central circuits mediating olfaction. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks so much, John, for that kind introduction. Although I like to think that we're all part of the same generation, you and I, the same generation. So I have to confess that I'm in my 45th year now, and as a single neuroscientist, I'm clearly in the midst of my midlife crisis, right? And so I've actually been spending much more time on Match.com and doing internet dating and experiments lately. So I'll talk about some of the work that's going on in my lab from other people. And what I'd like to talk about as part of my midlife crisis is this dream of going back to why I started in neuroscience. And the dream was trying to understand the biological basis of consciousness, right? I think that I'm still very far away from that, as many of us are, but I've decided to take a step back and I'm beginning to wonder whether even just a simple electrophysiologist like myself can start thinking about something like perception. Right? When I talk about perception, what I'm starting to get very interested in is trying to understand what a percept is. How is sensory information from the outside world represented by an ensemble of cells in the brain? So the area that, The area that we've been working on lately is the olfactory system. And the reason why that's so fun is that it's fun to work on circuits and synapses where you know something about the information that's coming in. And also, obviously, smell is very good at cocktail parties and even on dates to talk about, I'll tell you that. So just to give you a brief rundown of how the olfactory system works, all right, this would just be a schematic diagram if you took my head and cut it in half with an axe. And basically, the smells go in here in the nose. and odors, odor molecules, volatile compounds, bind to olfactory receptor neurons, odorant receptor neurons that are scattered in the nasal epithelium. These cells are excited by odorant molecules, and then the axons of olfactory receptor neurons project through these little holes in the base of the skull, the cribriform plate, where they make synaptic contacts at the first site where olfactory information is processed in the brain, which is this structure called the olfactory bulb. And one of the main reasons that I really started to get interested in the olfactory system is because, in contrast to systems like audition and somatosensation and vision, most of the central olfactory pathways bypass the thalamus. All right, so the output of the olfactory bulb makes direct contacts onto some very interesting parts of the brain, like the amygdala and like the piriform cortex, which is the major olfactory cortex in the brain. And why I find this very appealing is that this direct connection between sort of the olfactory bulb and these higher brain centers makes it very intriguing to think about the fact that olfactory cues are often very powerful ones for evoking strong emotional memories in our lives. And I know this for a fact because I remember very little of my first girlfriend, Sharon, but if I smell her perfume, white linen, white shoulders, white something, it makes me nauseous to this day. So given that sort of fascination, all right, I just want to tell you a little bit, very briefly, about the first steps of how olfactory information comes into the brain. And this was really blown open a number of years ago when Linda Buck and Richard Axel identified the gene family that encodes for the odorant receptors themselves. It turns out that there's about 1,000 different kinds of odorant receptors, and they're each expressed in individual types of olfactory receptor neurons. This information from the nose comes in via the olfactory nerve, where these axons make excitatory synaptic contacts on the very distal dendritic tuft of principal cells in the bulb, which are called mitral cells. And these contacts are made in very dense regions of neuropil that are called glomeruli. These are somewhat like barrels in the somatosensory cortex. And this information is propagated down a long primary dendrite, and then the information is passed on to higher brain centers via the axons of mitral cells that coalesce into something that's called the lateral olfactory tract, a very dense fiber bundle. And so what is so intriguing about the identification of the gene family coding for odorant receptors and what's come out through years of work is that it turns out that the axons from olfactory receptor neurons that express a receptor to one unique type of odorant receptor actually converge onto very specific glomeruli, only about one or two in the bulb. And so the idea has been put forward that the olfactory bulb and the glomeruli and the mitral cells, about the 50 or so that project to individual glomeruli, are actually set up to be a spatial map for the detection of odors in the bulb, right? And that work has been made clear by a lot of labs. And so just to give you a sense very early on, just to give you a feeling for what's happening in these mitral cells and what I'm not going to talk about here, as John alluded to, there's a lot of local processing by inhibitory circuits within the bulb. But first, we were just interested in how these mitral cells actually respond to odors in vivo. And to address that, we made whole cell patch clamp recordings from mitral cells in the olfactory bulb and anesthetized, urethane anesthetized, freely breathing rats where we applied odors with a little olfactometer. And shown down below here are just traces from two individual mitral cells and Kern clamp. So we're looking at the membrane potential of the cell. And down below is the respiration pattern of the animal. And what I want you to see is that when odors were applied, here these are single monomolecular odorant molecules, aliphatic aldehydes, or another cell where we applied complex odors like cinnamon, you can see that odors generally cause a depolarization in the mitral cell and a burst of spikes, a little burst of spikes, and this is actually very tightly coupled to the respiration cycle. Smell goes in, the mitral cells fire, smell goes off, they stop firing, right? And so one thing that we're very interested, just sort of given this pattern of the behavior of mitral cells and some of the work that I told you about in terms of the spatial map of how these odorant molecules are laid out in the bulb, it really takes us to the next point, which is that how does the brain know what the nose smells, or how does the brain actually know what the olfactory bulb is coding? Right, so what I've already just told you is that those olfactory bulb glomeruli essentially act as odorant molecular feature detectors, and odorants are represented in the bulb as a combinatorial code of active mitral cells, depending upon which patterns of those glomeruli and mitral cells are excited by particular odor molecules. And then finally, you know, what we decided to consider is that the spatiotemporal patterns of mitral cell activity have to be integrated elsewhere for odor perception, right? That seems very straightforward to us. And the first place we started to look at was the rat primary olfactory cortex. Right, so this is actually just a side view of a rat brain. Here's the olfactory bulb here, and this white bundle here, this big white blob, is actually the lateral olfactory tract. These are the axons coming from the mitral cells, which form synaptic contacts in this major region in the rat brain, at least, called the piriform cortex. And I've just overlaid the schematic to make it clearer that the fibers come in and map onto or form synaptic contacts onto this large region in the brain, piriform cortex, one of the major cortical regions devoted to the processing of olfactory information. And here I'm just showing you a schematic diagram that points to me some of the beauty of it as an electrophysiologist, and that is, in contrast to neocortex, the olfactory cortex is a very primordial structure. It's paleocortex. It only has three layers, very simple. So like I've told you before, the mitral cell axons coalesce from different glomeruli, and they project through this lateral olfactory tract where they make excitatory synaptic contacts on the very distal dendrites of pyramidal cells, which are densely packed in layer two of this part of the cortex. And what I just want to point out from some of the work from Linda Buck and a number of anatomical studies is that it's generally believed that projections of the mitral cell axons from individual glomeruli onto these pyramidal cells are stereotyped, diffuse, and overlapping, and that's sort of suggested here by this color pattern. Another thing that I want to point out, though we haven't studied it that extensively, is that in addition to this direct sensory input onto the cortex from the olfactory bulb, there are also associational pathways for excitatory synaptic input onto these same pyramidal cells. A certain fraction of these inputs are believed to arise from neighboring pyramidal cells in the olfactory cortex themselves, as well as coming from a lot of other cortical areas, input coming in actually onto a segregated region of the dendrites of these pyramidal cells. And it's generally thought, a nice way to think about this associational input coming from all other cortical structures, is that these synapses provide input that could influence the salience of olfactory afferent information. So I just want to start off at sort of the cellular level, trying to understand something about the properties of the sensory input onto these pyramidal cells. This is just an image here taken from a brain slice of the olfactory cortex. In this case, we have two stimulating electrodes placed there. You can see just by eye, although it doesn't show up here, a little dense band. That's the lateral olfactory tract. Here's the pyramidal cell layer. Here's a patch clamp recording electrode. And here's a stimulating electrode placed to excite the associational synapses. And one of the first things we wanted to do was convince ourselves that we could actually isolate direct sensory input onto these neurons. And fortunately, it turns out that one could take advantage of a pharmacological trick to convince oneself that you're studying sensory input coming from the olfactory bulb, and that is that presynaptic GABA B receptors, which are quite ubiquitously expressed throughout the brain and typically depress excitatory synaptic transmission, appear to be absent from the nerve terminals of sensory input into the olfactory cortex. So what's shown here is just a recording from a pyramidal cell where we simultaneously monitored with a paired pulse the excitatory postsynaptic current, or EPSC, at minus 80 millivolts in response to stimulation of the associational pathway and the lateral olfactory tract. And what's shown to the right is that after the application of baclofen, which is just this GABA-B agonist that we can use as this pharmacological tool, we completely abolish the excitatory synaptic input that's evoked from stimulation of these associational synapses. However, the direct, what we thought was the direct input from the lateral olfactory tract is in fact unaffected. So we have this nice tool that we've used subsequently in other experiments to convince ourselves that we can actually study sensory synapses specifically onto pyramidal cells. And one of the first things that I want to give you a flavor for is that pyramidal cells clearly receive inputs from multiple mitral cells. And that's very easy to show electrophysiologically, because if you record from a mitral cell in voltage clamp, and you hold it at minus 80 millivolts, so you can record excitatory synaptic transmission. If one has a stimulating electrode in the lateral olfactory tract and sets the stimulus strength, all right, first at a low level and then progressively increasing the stimulus strength, the shock that you're giving to that fiber bundle, you can see that the EPSC gets bigger and bigger and bigger as the stimulus strength is increased. And the simplest explanation for this is that as the strength of the shock is increased, you recruit more and more axons from the lateral olfactory tract to fire an action potential, and we see the resulting synaptic response in the cell get bigger. So clearly, these graded responses to that LOT stimulation tell us that pyramidal cells receive contacts from multiple mitral cells. Another thing that we wanted to consider is, what is the impact of a single mitral cell onto a single pyramidal cell? In other words, trying to get at how much does it take, how much sensory input does it take to get a pyramidal cell to fire a spike? So the first thing that we did to try and estimate the strength of a single connection from a mitral cell onto a pyramidal cell is to again record excitatory synaptic transmission evoked by stimulation in the lateral olfactory tract. But now we did what's called minimal stimulation, where we set the stimulation strength to a very, very tiny level, so that many of the times when we stimulate, we actually see failures of any synaptic transmission, and then sometimes we see successes. And this minimal stimulation protocol is used typically to try and isolate the input from what we believe is one single axon onto the cell. And what's shown here is just a plot of the amplitudes of the synaptic response over time in an experiment. This is an amplitude histogram, but the main point is that in this connection, the average strength of the axon contact onto the cell was quite weak. Weak in terms of the fact that it's about 10 picoamps in amplitude, about the strength of the input from a single vesicle's worth of glutamate onto a pyramidal cell. So this is what's consistent with a lot of single fiber inputs onto many cortical cells. However, what we found from doing a large variety of recordings is that we saw this incredible range in the strength of single fiber connections onto pyramidal cells. So here are two other examples where the strength of a single mitral cell axon could be 150 picoamps, and here even about 300 picoamps or so. And when we just show a summary from all the experiments that we did together, the average amplitude of a minimal EPSC, we would call it, is about 60 picoamps. All right, so what this is telling us is that there's a range of strength from individual mitral cells onto pyramidal cells from quite a low level to quite a high level, all right? And some of them can make very powerful contacts. So the next question, of course, is how many of those contacts on average might be required to be activated simultaneously to bring a pyramidal cell to threshold for a spike, to actually sort of try and represent that information coming from the olfactory bulb. And the approach to address that is shown here. We first start off using a patch electrode in what's called the cell-attached mode. So we have the patch electrode stuck onto the membrane of the cell, but we haven't gained access to the inside of the cell. And we set the stimulus strength in the lateral olfactory tract to the point that on about 50% of the stimulus trials, we can actually detect an action potential that's evoked into that cell that we've isolated with our patch electrode, right? So this is cell-attached recording to sort of monitor the strength of the input that it takes to bring the cell to what we call threshold for firing a spike. And after we've figured out that stimulus strength, we then bust into the cell through our patch electrode and then record the amplitude of the underlying excitatory synaptic current that brought that pyramidal cell to threshold for a spike. And on average, what we found is sort of shown to the right here. This is just a histogram showing the time course of when these single action potentials occurred, of course, across all of the experiments with short latency after the stimulation. But most importantly, shown down below here, is that we found the average amplitude of the input that's required to bring the cell to threshold is about 300 picoamps. And what you can do is sort of back calculate from the number that I told you before about the average strength of an individual axon. And what that tells us is that on average, only about five fibers or five mitral cell axons would have to be active simultaneously to bring the cell to threshold for a spike. All right, so does that really tell us anything? And I kind of think it does, and the way I would think about it is that this would suggest that the olfactory cortex, right, the piriform cortex, is not set up to be a situation for sparse coding. In other words, a sparse code to me would mean that the only way you could bring a pyramidal cell to threshold is that if you had to have the synchronous activation of many, many, many weak inputs to bring the cell to threshold. That's a case where we might have had specialized cells in our brain, like a pizza neuron or a coffee neuron or a wine neuron. I don't think that's the case. Rather, I think this is more consistent with the idea that there must be a sort of broad and very distributed ensemble coding of odors in the cortex. And this was sort of nice suggestive work getting at something about, you know, how information is first encoded in the cortex. And we decided recently to try another approach, and that is to try and image ensembles of cells in the olfactory cortex in response to activation of the olfactory bulb. And the way that we took to approach this is shown here. We basically came up with a slice preparation, big slab of tissue that has the olfactory bulb, and these are experiments that are done from rats or mice, that has the olfactory bulb essentially attached to a chunk of the olfactory cortex over here to the left, right? And for all the aficionados, the glomerular layer of the olfactory bulb is out here. There's a mitral cell layer that winds around the interior. And shown, you know, just by this green sort of road map here is the pathway of the lateral olfactory tract as it exits this section of the olfactory bulb and moves towards the cortex. What we do then is that we have a stimulating electrode in our first experiments. It's just plopped down in the mitral cell layer. Right, so we can activate a bunch of mitral cells and presumably axons in the lateral olfactory tract. Right, so how do we image activity? Basically, this whole slab of tissue has been soaked in a calcium indicator dye, Oregon Green 1. And the goal is to use calcium imaging as an index of activity in the olfactory cortex. So what we do is have the stimulating electrode over here in the bulb, and then we image a region miles away, on the scale for us, several hundred microns away, over here in the olfactory cortex. So what I'm going to show you now is sort of an experiment sort of showing how we might set up the whole approach. This is a region of the olfactory cortex, and the different layers are illustrated there to the left. The cell body layer is down here. The peel surface is up here. The whole thing is soaked in a calcium indicator dye. And what's shown over here is an imaging region when we image essentially layer two. What you can see is that following a burst of stimuli, a little train of stimuli to that region of the olfactory bulb, we see a lot of these little bright spots here. Essentially, they look like flowers, all right? This is actually a delta F over F. This is sort of the peak fluorescence in response, or the fluorescence change in response to stimulation in the olfactory bulb. And shown to the right here is just sort of a spatially averaged report of the calcium signal showing a nice rise in fluorescence or an increase in calcium in this cell body layer. It's sort of like a field recording or a population recording of activity. What's shown here is the same field of view, right, the same intensity level that I mapped it before. After we apply glutamate receptor, the glutamate receptor antagonists NBQX and APB to the slice, that completely abolishes those little bright spots of fluorescence, which are on the, represent the soma or the cell bodies of pyramidal cells. This suggests to us that that response that we're seeing in this layer 2-3 of the olfactory cortex requires synaptic input, excitatory synaptic input. However, we didn't just kill the slice, because then if we move our imaging region in the presence of those glutamate receptor blockers up to this region where the lateral olfactory tract makes its connections onto those cells, we actually see a nice calcium signal, which is essentially the calcium influx through the presynaptic nerve terminals coming from the olfactory bulb. So we really like this idea, first that we could image both pre- and postsynaptic activity in the cortex, but more importantly, we decided to use these patterns of activation of pyramidal cells in the olfactory cortex as a representation of the ensembles of cells that can be driven from activity in the olfactory bulb. And this slide is just to convince you that those calcium transients that we see in the pyramidal cells occur because of action potentials that are evoked in those cells. We're seeing calcium influx that's mediated from an action potential in the cell body of pyramidal cells, and that's sort of shown here. Here's just a region at very high magnification of a number of pyramidal cells loaded with Oregon Green 1. We made a cell-attached patch clamp recording on a single cell. We set the stimulus strength so that in the loose patch mode, when we gave a shock on about 50% of the trials, there was an action potential that we can record in cell-attached mode. And what's shown here are the calcium transients that we measured in response to those same stimulus trials. And sometimes there was a calcium transient, and sometimes there wasn't. And here you can see to the right, if we just pull out and group those trials where there were spikes in that cell from ones where there were no spikes, we see all the calcium transients that we measure correspond to the action potential, and when there wasn't a spike, there was none. So we use this calcium indicator just to say, is a cell activated or not activated? Does it reach threshold or not? All right, so what do we do? I've given you this long setup for this preparation. So what we do is that instead of stimulating directly in the mitral cell layer, we wanted to get a sense of how odors might be encoded in the cortex. Now, some of you are saying, well, we don't have the nose in this preparation, so how can we get at that issue? Well, essentially what we decided to do was be the nose. And what we did was that we took advantage of the fact that we could put very focal stimulating electrodes in that glomerular layer of the olfactory bulb, right, to try and excite just a very small number of glomeruli relative to the whole population, and there's about 1,800 of them all throughout the olfactory bulb. So here are shown two stimulus electrodes in the olfactory bulb of one of those bulb cortex slices. And again, using calcium imaging, and this has really been blown up on a very high scale, here we're looking at the response to the stimulation of one electrode, all right, activating a region of glomeruli here and some mitral cells. Here's the response to the second stimulating electrode that's spaced far away from the first. And here's the response of two of them at the same time, which generally just looks like the linear sum of each of them alone. All right. So after setting up these conditions, we then move back our imaging region to the olfactory cortex. And so what's shown here is on a sort of low power view, a region of the olfactory cortex that responded to stimulation in what we're calling stimulus one here in the olfactory bulb. And what you can see is this little pattern of spots. I'm just showing you a map of the cells that are activated after they've been thresholded and gone through some image processing. But these little spots represent activation of pyramidal cells. And if you need a sense of the distance here, each one of these spots is about the size of a single cell body, which is 20 microns or so. So we see that pattern of activity in that region of the cortex in response to stimulus one. When we stimulate that other sort of adjacent and non-overlapping area of glomeruli, we see essentially a different ensemble of cells that are activated, and those are mapped in green here. Now I've overlaid on this image the cells that were activated from stimulus one, just with the red circles. And one thing you can see is that although it's a different set of neurons, there is some overlap between the two groups of cells that have been recruited. And on average, what we find is that this overlap is about between 10 and 20%, right? Overlap between the cells that are recruited from two independent glomeruli. And then finally, what we were very interested in is what was the response in the olfactory cortex when we stimulated those two glomerular regions at the same time. And what we found is shown here in the purple. The purple here shows all the cells that were activated when we did the simultaneous stimulation of those two glomeruli. Shown in black are just overlaid all the cells that were activated by stimulus one and stimulus two alone. And what I want you to notice here is that we saw a huge increase in the number of cells, or the ensemble of cells, that were activated when we stimulated these two glomeruli at the same time. One would call it a very supralinear, all right, response here, and we can measure that numerically by just taking all the cells that are activated when we stimulate these two glomeruli at the same time and divide that by all the cells that are activated by stimulus one and stimulus two alone, minus those that are overlapping. And in a number of experiments, what we generally see is about a doubling of the number of cells that are active when the two inputs are stimulated simultaneously than you would get from the linear sum of each alone. And why might this be interesting? Well, to me, it sort of says that there's an entirely novel representation, right, of the information from these two glomerular regions that's mapped onto the cortex when they're activated simultaneously than when each of these inputs is activated alone. All of these new cells essentially are telling us something completely different about a mixture, if we might want to think about it, of odors and the individual components alone. So next obvious question is, where does this sort of supralinear behavior that we see arise from? Is it something that's going on at the level of the olfactory bulb, or is it actually a property of the cortical structure itself? And to address that, we just did the same experiment, but now without the olfactory bulb attached to the cortex. And what we did was use two stimulating electrodes spaced far apart in the lateral olfactory tract so that we could activate independent but overlapping sets of axons that converged onto a same population of pyramidal cells. And we had an extracellular recording electrode so that we could monitor the extracellular field EPSP at the same time. So what's shown up on the top here first is the response of the field EPSP to stimulation of one pathway alone, LOT1, then the second pathway, and then the two activated at the same time. And what's superimposed here is the digital sum of these two pathways together, just trying to convince you that we're generally activating two completely independent, largely independent sets of axons that are coming into the same region. Here are the pyramidal cells that were activated in the cortex to the first pathway. Again, the cells in green here are those that were recruited by the second pathway. And then shown here on the right in purple are all the new cells that we saw when we activated those two pathways at the same time. So this sort of suggested to us straight away that this sort of supralinear representation of the sensory input is something that doesn't have to occur in the olfactory bulb, it's actually occurring in the cortex alone. And just to sort of show it to you another way, what we've shown here is the actual calcium transients that occur in four different cells on a trial-by-trial basis, all right? And so what I want you to see here, rather than an activity map, which we typically make from averaging a number of trials together, here are all the individual trials. And what I'm showing you are sort of all the possibilities that I showed you with some of those spatial maps, that there are some cells that never respond, that never fire a spike in response to activation of each independent pathway alone. However, when they're stimulated together, we then see on a trial-by-trial basis very effective activity in those pyramidal cells, as well as the fact that there are other cells that sometimes don't respond to one pathway but can respond variably to another, that now respond very faithfully when the two inputs are activated simultaneously. And then finally, just a little summary down below of about 12 experiments. We just plot sort of this linearity index here. If all of this activity was entirely linear, all of the points would fall on this straight line here at 1. On average, we see, like I told you from the bulb cortex slices, about a doubling of the cells that are represented when the two inputs are activated simultaneously than the sum of the two alone. And for the aficionados, we did a number of these experiments in that drug baclofen, all right, which we can use again to suppress associational inputs. And what we found is that we still see this sort of supralinear recruitment of neurons in the olfactory cortex in the presence of baclofen, which suppresses those associational synapses. Right? So it's not that all the supralinearity just requires sort of recurrent excitation alone. And then finally, another experiment that we did was ask something about this time window, all right, over which we see this supralinear behavior. And in terms of the time window, what we did again, just with an isolated olfactory cortex, was set up the condition where if we activated one pathway, we saw one ensemble of cells. We activated a different pathway, we saw a different ensemble of cells. Here are the two different ensembles shown together, all right, when each is activated independently. And then shown down below here, all right, are three different trials where we spaced out the timing between those two pathways, all right? This is the stimulation of the two pathways at exactly the same time. Again, the pink circles represent the cells that were newly recruited as opposed to what you would get just from the linear sum. And then shown to the right here is just what happens as we vary that time interval between the two stimuli, 20 milliseconds and 50 milliseconds. And what's shown here is that by around 50 milliseconds, we actually don't see any of this sort of supralinear behavior, and we can map out this time course from a number of experiments shown down below. And what this is actually telling us is that this time window for getting this supralinear recruitment occurs on the order of about 20 to 30 milliseconds or so, right? Any longer than that and you lose it. And why is that sort of interesting to us? What we're essentially looking at is the integration time window of synaptic inputs onto pyramidal cells. And it actually is a very narrow window for getting this novel representation of sensory input when two different sort of odor pathways are activated synchronously as opposed to their sum. And this was good to us because rats generally sniff at a frequency of about 2 to 8 hertz. And having a brief integration time window would allow pyramidal cells to discriminate odor input on basically a sniff-by-sniff basis, as they appear to do in behavior. And then just one last thing with the imaging, I've just shown you that we're sort of seeing this novel representation or this enhancement or this supralinear recruitment of pyramidal cells when two different odor pathways or channels are active at the same time than when each is activated alone. That would seem to disrupt the ability, perhaps, to discriminate inputs, right? So one question we wanted to know was, when you get these supralinear representations in the cortex, how unique are they, right? And we did that experiment, essentially, just like I told you of some of the others, except now we use three independent pathways in the lateral olfactory tract. We stimulated three independent sets of inputs, and we got three essentially unique patterns of ensembles of cells that were activated by each. And then what's shown down below here, like I've shown you before, the colored cells represent those new cells that were recruited when we stimulated 1 and 2 together, or 2 and 3 together, or 1 and 3 together up here. Now what's shown down below here is essentially just a comparison of all the new cells, all right, in response to these different three different patterns of stimuli compared across each other, all right? And what I'm trying to show you here is that if we compare sort of the supralinear representation with these two input pathways or these two input pathways, the fact that a lot of them are green here and a lot of them are still red here and very few of them are common suggests to us that you can still preserve uniqueness with this supralinear recruitment of neurons in the pyramidal in the piriform cortex. So just to quickly sum up this part, what I've tried to tell you is something about the organization, I think, of olfactory cortex, and that, we believe, says that the convergence and overlap of sensory inputs, basically anatomically and functionally, leads to this nonlinear activation of cortical pyramidal cells. In other words, there's nothing magical. This is just how the anatomy is most likely set up. And in terms of odor coding, we think what this says is that odor mixtures are represented by unique ensembles of cortical cells that are actually distinct from those activated by the individual odor components. All right, just for the last few minutes of the talk here, I want to switch gears and go to a different level. We sort of went from the single cell in the slice to trying to get a grasp on what's happening in populations of cells in the olfactory cortex. And now one other question we're interested in is, how do these cells in the olfactory cortex respond to odor input in vivo, to natural stimuli? And to address that, we did the same sort of experiments, the same preparation that I told you before, except now we're going to be using patch clamp recording of neurons in the olfactory cortex and look at their responses to odors. And the approach that we've taken is to first start off by trying to monitor the spike output of neurons of cells in the olfactory cortex in response to odors by first maintaining that cell-attached mode that I told you about before, so we could pick up spikes from the single isolated cells. And then after screening their response to some odors, then bust into the cell, have access to it, and then monitor the synaptic input into the cell using voltage clamp recording. All right? So this next slide just shows an example of a cell in the cell-attached mode where we found that it responded to a monomolecular compound, amyl acetate. And what's shown here is the respiration cycle. What's shown down below here is just a raster and then a histogram of all of these spikes. And the main point I want you to take from this is that overall, we find that in vivo, in an anesthetized animal anyway, pyramidal cells are generally quiescent in the absence of odors. They essentially never spike, very, very rarely. And when one does see an odor-evoked response in the cell, the spikes are generally occur in little tiny bursts that are more or less coupled to this respiration cycle. Not so surprising, since I told you that was how the mitral cells seem to propagate this activity in the first place. All right, what we then do after sort of screening the response of the output of the cell with the cell attached recording is break in. And we then do voltage clamp recordings using an internal solution that we dialyze the cell with, a cesium gluconate internal, which allows us to monitor excitatory synaptic transmission at minus 80 millivolts. All right, and what's shown down here is just a trace of the currents occurring into the cell. Here's the respiration cycle. Here is when the odor was applied to the same cell that we just showed you, responded with spikes to amyl acetate. And one thing that you can notice, although the cell is generally quiescent and never spikes at rest, is that there's an ongoing flurry. These little downward deflections here on a very compressed time scale is this ongoing barrage of excitatory synaptic input. And when amyl acetate was applied, we essentially see this large enhancement in the odor-evoked or the excitatory synaptic currents that are impinging upon the cell. What I want to show you down here is just to try and convince you that a lot of this synaptic activity is in fact very tightly coupled or reasonably coupled to the respiration cycle, and that's just shown here by comparing the power spectra, all right, of both the respiration signal, which is shown in black. The animal is generally breathing at about 2 hertz in this anesthetized state. And then in green is the power spectrum of all the synaptic current trace, right? And they show a nice peak here at about the same time. All right, so that's the excitatory synaptic currents, all right? The beauty of this whole cell recording and using an internal solution that we design is that we can then move from minus 80 millivolts, which we've essentially clamped to be, the reversal potential for inhibitory synaptic currents, and then take the membrane potential of the cell to 0 millivolts, which is now giving us a large driving force to measure inhibitory synaptic input at the same point that it's a membrane potential that's at the reversal potential for excitatory synaptic currents. So we can isolate, essentially, with the membrane potential of the cell, pure inhibitory synaptic currents. And what's shown here is just a little schematic to remind me to say that, like other cortical areas, it's generally thought that local inhibitory circuits that are made up of what are called feed-forward interneurons, those that are excited by the afferent input coming into the system and can immediately inhibit pyramidal cells are believed to be in place in this cortex, as well as feedback interneurons that would be activated by the axons of local pyramidal cells in this circuit to cause inhibition. And so we are very interested to get a sense for what the role of inhibition is relative to excitation in these pyramidal cells. So this is, again, the response of the same cell and voltage clamp. Now it's at about plus 10 millivolts, where we can isolate electrically the inhibitory postsynaptic currents, or iPSCs, onto the same cell. And again, what you can see is that even much more so than the excitatory synaptic current, there's sort of this ongoing rhythm or this barrage of inhibitory postsynaptic currents that, if anything, are very tightly locked to the respiration cycle, and again, that's shown by this power spectrum below. And what's shown here is that amyl acetate also caused an enhancement of this inhibitory synaptic current that was impinging upon the same cell. So that's just sort of the basics of what one might see in one of these cells in the olfactory cortex in vivo. One next question we really wanted to consider is one that's arise from a lot of computational modeling and other groups of interest, which have tried to understand how much of the excitatory input or the drive onto one of these pyramidal cells in cortex is truly just direct sensory input, as opposed to some of that recurrent or associational input that might come from neighboring pyramidal cells. And we decided to address that question using that trick that I told you about a while ago, using baclofen, all right? Except now we use baclofen in vivo, which will only suppress the associational inputs or any of the recurrent connections amongst pyramidal cells in the cortex, but should spare the sensory input from the lateral olfactory tract. And here's a response of a cell that we're looking at the EPSCs and the iPSCs. This cell responded to amyl acetate with excitation, an increase in excitation, and an increase in inhibition. Shown to the right are individual traces from the same cell after you put a drop of baclofen right on the surface of the cortex. And what you can see here is that essentially the excitatory synaptic input, or the average as shown here of a number of trials under control and baclofen, is essentially unaffected, right? And so that's really telling us that most of this excitatory drive onto the pyramidal cell is coming directly from the lateral olfactory tract. The beauty of monitoring the inhibitory synaptic currents in the same cell is that baclofen, while it will suppress any associational inputs which might be driving inhibition, it also directly causes inhibition of transmitter release from interneurons themselves via GABA-B autoreceptors. And so when we put on baclofen, a nice control that it's actually gotten in is that it essentially abolishes all inhibitory synaptic transmission onto the cell, as we would expect, right? So taken together, we think that direct sensory input underlies the major amount of odor-evoked excitation onto the neuron. All right, when things start to get interesting are when we try and look at the response of an individual pyramidal cell to several different odors. So shown here is a cell-attached patch recording of the output or the spiking activity in the cell to three different compounds. This is cineol. This is amyl acetate, and then a complex odor, lavender oil. And what you can see is that, well, first of all, this cell is a little bit more spontaneously active than the vast majority that we see, but it seemed to show an increase in spike output to one of these three odors, amyl acetate. All right? So for us, you know, we begin to think, what's underlying the spiking output of the cell in terms of the synaptic input? Is it that there's a lot of synaptic inhibition and maybe it goes away with the amyl acetate, or is it just something that's due to an increase in excitation? We can address that again by making voltage clamp recordings from the same cell, monitoring the excitatory synaptic input and monitoring the inhibitory synaptic input into the same cell. And what you can see here is that essentially the cell only responded with excitation to the one odorant that caused spike output in the cell. However, what we found is that each one of these odors, though they didn't do anything at all in terms of the excitatory input, all caused a large increase and almost a very similar increase in the inhibitory input onto the same cell. And we actually find that quite striking, because of what it's sort of suggesting is a scenario where excitation is quite specific or quite narrowly tuned, if you like that word, in the olfactory cortex, whereas inhibition seems to be much more global, right? Much more broadly tuned. And I just want to give you a sense from a population of cells. These are all early days. What we found is that odors evoke synaptic input, first of all, in a much larger population of cells than those that reach threshold. And we sort of like this because a lot of traditional studies using unit recordings, all right, generally are biased, we think, for those cells that are very heavily active, all right. And what I'm showing you here is just a summary of all the cells that we recorded, all right, in cell attached mode first. And what we're just looking at is for each cell, we test it with four different odors, and we're just looking at the fraction of all the cells that we recorded that responded to any one of those odors. Did it show us an odor response? And on average, only about 20% of the cells that we looked at actually fired spikes in response to any one odor. However, about twice as many would show excitation in response to any one odor. And many more than that, about 50%, we saw inhibition. All right. So this on itself, we think is kind of nice, because it says that it's more likely that one drives inhibition onto the cell even than excitation. But it gets interesting when you start breaking this population of cells down further in terms of those that only responded to one of the four odors, right? And so if we ask what happened in those cells that showed a response to only one of the four odors, the vast majority of the cells that spiked only did so in response to one of four odors, all right? And now when we compare what happened with those cells that showed spikes to only two odors, or only three odors, or all four, you can see this vast reduction in those cells that responded with spikes as we sort of made it a comparison between how many odors they responded to. Similarly, we saw with excitation, about 40% of the cells that responded with excitation responded to only one odor, or only two odors, and then very few and virtually none responded to all four of the odors that were tested on them. In contrast, inhibition looked very different, and we found that the vast majority of the cells that responded with inhibition always did so to each of the four odors that we applied. All right, what might underlie this? We think it's likely that the interneurons themselves that drive that inhibition are probably more likely to receive odor-evoked excitation than pyramidal cells, right? And so we could test that, and we began testing that by recording from cells that we could identify. While most of the cells I told you about before were always recorded in layer 2-3, the pyramidal cell layer, we started to go for superficial cells in essentially the region a little bit below the lateral olfactory tract that contain nice interneurons. And here are two examples of recordings from cells that we recovered so we could identify, at least morphologically, as pyramidal cells and interneurons. And what's shown on the top here is the response of a pyramidal cell to one of four, to each of these four odors. The average responses of the EPSC and the IPSCs are shown in red, just pointing out again that although this cell maybe gave a little bit of an excitatory response to one odor, there was strong inhibition onto the cell for each of the four odors. And in contrast, when we look at an interneuron, what we see is that it essentially showed an excitatory response to all four of these same odors, as well as inhibition, right, as well as inhibition, but clearly stronger excitation onto that cell. And this is summarized in a small group of cells that we've been working on just to now. This is all pretty preliminary, but if we just compare, again, with that sort of same metric that I showed you before, you know, the percent of cells that we recorded that responded to any one of the odors that we applied, we always see pyramidal cells much more likely to respond with inhibition than excitation. And here what we can see is that the interneurons that we've identified morphologically, about 80% of the cells that we've recorded always seem to respond with odor-evoked excitation, as well as some inhibition, and more likely to spike. So taken together, I think we're beginning to try and work out a little bit some of the underlying circuitry that's giving rise to some of these patterns. I don't have time to go into it today, but we think it'll be fun to work out how this microcircuit of interneurons and pyramidal cells leads to the representation of what we hope someday to figure out might be a percept in the cortex. And I just want to thank the people who did this work at the end. Jinhua Kang did the olfactory bulb in vivo work. He's now an assistant professor at Northwestern. Kevin Franks did the cortex integration experiments and brain slices. He's now a postdoc with Richard Axel. Alfonso Apicella started the bulb cortex imaging. He's now doing a postdoc with Mike DeWeese. Cindy Poo is a graduate student doing the heroic recordings in cortex in vivo. And thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeff. Are you ready to ask some questions?
Sure.
Questions?
So what do you know about the frontal amplitude neuron?
Right. So I didn't have time to talk about it today. We've been working out the properties of both the feed, what we think are feed forward and feedback interneurons. So here's just an example of a layer one interneuron, all right, that we can show in a paired recording when we fire spikes in that interneuron, cause iPSCs in a pyramidal cell. Here's the anatomy of one of these cells. They have extensive dendrites that are just in that layer one region where they're poised to get this LOT input. Curiously, their axons, shown in red, completely ignore the cell body layer, and the axon of that interneuron that I just showed you is only in the dendritic region of the olfactory cortex. And more importantly, we've been looking at this question about integration and convergence onto these, what we think are feed-forward interneurons. I don't show you the single fiber amplitudes here, but they're essentially equivalent to what we see in pyramidal cells. We figured out what it takes to bring them to spike threshold, and essentially, in comparison to pyramidal cells, they're more or less the same. Maybe it requires a stronger amount of excitatory input to bring the pyramidal cell to threshold, to bring the interneuron to threshold, sorry, than the pyramidal cell. But more importantly, it's what's shown here, the idea of convergence. When we simultaneously record from a pyramidal cell and an interneuron at the same time, and we just start adjusting the stimulus strength in the lateral olfactory tract to recruit more and more and more fibers, we've always seen in every case that the interneuron receives much, much more recruitment of this lateral olfactory tract or sensory input than the pyramidal cell. So it looks like, all things being equal, it's just a matter of a much higher convergence of axons from mitral cells onto individual interneurons as opposed to pyramidal cells that we think is setting up this global inhibition. Yeah. Yes. Doing three at the same time to make it even more superlinear. No, we haven't tried that, but we'd expect you'd see more activation if you did three at the same time. Yeah. Yes. Right. That's right. Right. That's right. So I didn't show this data here, but what we found in the slice is that what I showed you in the talk was the response to one single shock, all right? Just basically one action potential in the mitral cells that are impinging onto the pyramidal cell in vitro. But we also did the same experiment with little bursts of spikes, right? Little trains of stimuli to mimic what we've seen, what we recorded ourselves occurs in the olfactory bulb. And you're absolutely right. What we found was that under conditions that we think are more physiological, all right, when there are trains of spikes coming in, you do drop down to the level where it can only be maybe one or a couple of mitral cells that are sufficient to bring the cell to threshold for firing a spike. The stuff in vivo is occurring on a much slower time scale, even smeared out, you know, more so than we did with the stimuli. But it is quite possible that it might be that the impact of just one or a couple of mitral cells that are active is enough to make it spike. That's possible. Yeah. Right. So that's a very good question because the best work that was addressing sort of the mapping of olfactory information in the cortex came from Linda Buck's group that did an anatomical study using, an anterograde transsynaptically delivered reporter. And what was found in the literature is that there seemed to be somewhat discrete regions of input from specific glomeruli that were connected in the olfactory cortex. All I can tell you is that we never found evidence, in our slice work. Now it's in vitro, right? So it's a slice, and we've removed a lot of the inherent connectivity. We never seem to see, right, any very precise targeting of one area onto another. In fact, we always design the experiments to be such when we would stimulate one region of the olfactory bulb, we saw an area that was activated, right? That's what we imaged when we stimulated the other region of the olfactory bulb, right? So I can't tell you that we saw any discrete, patterns or topography from our experiments that would suggest that. Yes?
I wanted to ask about what you think about sparse protein.
Yeah.
So you provided some very strong information about things are not so sparse.
Yes.
It doesn't take many particles.
Yes. Yes.
But then there's this tremendous, very widespread
Yes.
So in the end, how do you think about it?
Right. Obviously, I think very poorly about it because I'm just a simple electrophysiologist. And so first, I think I tended to break it down to the simplest level, which is forgetting about inhibition, right? And I just thought, let's just see how the system is wired, right, in terms of the mitral cells. And it certainly seemed to be wired in this sort of broad and distributed pattern, right? What I would say I've learned, what I would say I've learned is that most likely inhibition, right, is what's most significant in shaping, at least in vivo, I think these patterns. In specifically, what I think is this very broad inhibition is broad, right? Inhibition is completely broad and is always working to suppress, activity throughout this network, right? And so it's only going to be some very special, pyramidal cells, right? But presumably a fairly significant population, all right, that are going to overcome that inhibition and fire spikes.
So do you have a sense for what fraction of the pyramidal cells are responding?
Well, so it depends on how you want to look at our numbers, and this is by no means systematic, This was very early data, and we'd love to do these experiments with many, many more odors, obviously, and at very, very tiny concentrations to just be looking at threshold. The problem is with the whole cell recordings, you can't keep them for ages. So we're always in this trade-off between trying to sample a lot of different odors and trying to get many trials to look at, right? And we're always making this trade-off. In one sense, you could say, at least with the odors that we've applied, and I think you're better to interpret it than I am, of all the cells that we record from, all right, like 20% of the cells will respond to one of four odors, right, with spikes. Now, admittedly, it's a high odor concentration. I don't know how much the olfactory bulb is activated, right, with each of those odors. But on the one hand, you could say that that's not a sign of sparseness, right? If just four odors will activate 20% of the cells that we patch onto, right, it's got to be quite broad in my mind.
Yeah.
it might be very different under very, very, you know, low odor concentrations at the level of threshold detection. I don't know. Yes? Yeah. So all those experiments in the cortex, you know, with the calcium imaging, were done with a field electrode to monitor the field EPSB when we constructed those same imaging trials. I'm not sure if that's what you're getting at. And so we always did it just like that. Yeah. Sorry. Yes.
So you showed that there is an inhibitory.
Yeah, and this is consistent with a lot of other groups that have suggested, you know, very interesting, you know, interneuron connectivity patterns, right?
So that should ultimately also result in excitation. Could that explain the supralinear phenomenon?
Yeah, I'm hesitant to say anything about the role of the inhibitory networks in that supralinear, you know, recruitment. What I didn't show you here, right, is that if I did these same experiments that I just showed you and showed you some of those nice patterns that were quite distinct, if I put on a drug that blocks GABA A receptors by bicuculain, all right, and gave the same stimulation, you know, clearly inhibition is doing something, because you would just see woof, you know, you would just see this fireworks, right, occurring. Certainly there is going to be some role that inhibition is shaping in that superlinearity. I don't know what it is yet.
Get a last question?
Yeah.
You look at the interneuron while you're doing a multiple LOT.
Yes.
Is there superlinear linearity in their activation?
We haven't looked at, you know, obviously one thing we'd love to do is just be able to someday do all the sort of population imaging, you know, with an animal, you know, from a mouse where all the interneurons were labeled, and we could go and say, you know, this is the recruitment of interneurons versus pyramidal cells. We haven't done it, but that, you know, that would be a wonderful question to look at.
All right. Thank you.
Thank
you.
Yep.
Thank you.